720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch Christmas Eve edition and Hanukkah Eve, too. So I see lots of shoppers out and about, but you know what? I don't see a lot of people carrying a lot of packages, so maybe everybody got all the shopping done and everybody is just enjoying some time with family and friends, as I hope that you are all doing. Still lots to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch today. We're going to be talking about those vacation days that we didn't use all year and now we got a bunch of to deal with. We're going to be talking about that a little bit and why we do that and what we can do about it in the year ahead. We're also going to be talking about Wikipedia. In particular, we're going to be talking about who writes Wikipedia and why that matters to consider, and year-end giving. Of course, that is a big thing. We see all those appeals in our mailboxes, right? But before we do that, let's talk about workplace wellness. We're joined right now by author and healthcare expert Al Lewis. He is the author of several books. One of them is called Surviving Workplace Wellness with Your Dignity, Finances, and Major Organs Intact. Welcome to the program, Al.
Well, thank you for having me on, Amy.
Well, this is a really fascinating topic because I think when we think about workplace wellness, we think, oh, that's so nice. Now my workplace is, you know, offering yoga or doing this. We hear about this just kind of vague wellness program, but we're not really sure what's in it. But then sometimes there are things kind of forced upon us that we may not necessarily want. And it looks like the data that you're looking at anyway and that you've been sharing with people throughout your career is pointing towards maybe they're really not doing that much good, but maybe they're just kind of a way of like a front for shifting costs to employees. Talk to us about that, if you would.
Okay, well, let's distinguish a couple of things. First, there's wellness done for employees, like offering gym memberships and yoga and better food. And then there's wellness done to employees, and that's where they line you up to take your blood and make you fill out forms and tell you all the things that are wrong with you. That's where the problem is. Sometimes I say wellness can be hazardous to your health.
No doubt. Well, you know, I think a lot of people start getting into getting a little defensive when it comes to like those biometric screenings and the HRAs, the health risk assessments, because not only is it, you know, you have to like give a blood sample or get weighed or, you know, meet with somebody and you're forced to do that as part of your workplace wellness program. But also it seems like there's some privacy issues and potentially some, you know, personal stuff that might come up that you may not want to know your employer to know about.
Well, you know, yes, there is. And I personally might possibly be okay with that as a trade-off for better health. The problem is that these programs don't make your health better. In fact, the one that just won the award in 2016 made, according to their own data, made the health of the Boise school employees worse. So why are companies paying money to invade employees' privacy and potentially make their health worse?
Exactly my question to you. Why in the world would they do that then? If indeed it's kind of backfiring on them, and is it just that it sounds really good, or is it about putting costs on employees, or both?
Yes, it sounds good. Yes, when employees don't participate, they lose a big bonus. And by the way, the bonus is illusory. Typically, the companies will switch to a high-deductible health plan and say, but you can earn it back with wellness. But the big thing is that vendors and consultants are simply lying to them. I mean, they're just lying to companies about the money that can be saved. And you don't have to take my word for it. I have a $2 million reward out for anyone who can show that wellness has saved money. There are rules and entries and everything. And then you can just Google on Al Lewis and $2 million reward for wellness and find it.
Yeah, I've been reading about this, and this is a real thing that you're doing because you believe so strongly that really this idea of these workplace wellness programs are really doing, not doing any good, but they're in fact harming people, that you legitimately have a $2 million reward that you're willing to give anyone who can kind of debunk the work that you're doing and have a different, not interpretation, but prove it otherwise.
Well, this is math, and I have it's simple arithmetic, and I have a proof. And the thing about an arithmetic proof versus a science proof is you can't dispute it. There's no such thing as a counter proof,
right,
in arithmetic. But yeah, I mean the award is legit. You can look it up, and there are a couple of catches. One, you have to take a lie detector test, as do I.
Okay.
We both take lie detector tests. And number two, there is an entry fee. It's $2 million, and the entry fee is $100,000, but you get that back with the $2 million. And no one has taken me up on it. And all the people, I mean, there's a whole group of just world-class liars. And I mention names on my website. I don't think I need to do it on the air. And I keep challenging them to take me up on the reward. And they say, well, $2 million is a lot of money, but I don't need it. That's the kind of thing they say.
I see. I mean, I'll take $2 million, but I don't know how to take on your theories because they sound really compelling. So what about an employer, perhaps someone who's listening now, who's thinking, but gosh, I want to do this for my employees. I want to do something. I want my employees to be healthy. What is the right way to do this? Or do we need to just kind of scrap the idea of workplace wellness programs and just rebuild them completely?
Well, there is a way to make your employees healthier, possibly make your employees healthier using workplace wellness. And that is, there are established clinical guidelines. They're put out by something called the United States Preventive Services Task Force. And they tell you how often you should get your blood sugar checked, your cholesterol, blood pressure, et cetera. All you need to do as an employer is adhere to those guidelines. But the vendors are having none of it because literally, if you adhere to the guidelines, you'll reduce your spending on wellness by about two-thirds, which means vendors only get a third of the revenue. The entire industry would go bankrupt if employers actually started adhering to established clinical guidelines.
Mm. It is really interesting and such a kind of murky topic. There was a Slate piece a few months ago in which you are mentioned and your work is mentioned that really also, you know, brings these points very, you know, sharply into focus too, mentioning times where employees were straight up misdiagnosed with major illnesses or given really terrible advice or it backfired on them when they're perhaps sexual habits or family planning and things like that came into knowledge in the workplace, things like that. But in particular, just straight up bad advice and misdiagnoses seem the most, I mean, that seems very dire. That can make someone make a fatal error really quickly. That could put someone in harm's way very immediately. What is the answer to that?
Well, that's the Slate article. I recommend everyone look at it. Just go to Slate and wellness is a scam. Just Google those two things and you'll find it. And what was more interesting than the article was the massive number of employee comments they got, or comments from people, most of whom were complaining about their wellness program. It literally got 10 times the average number of Facebook shares and comments because it's such a compelling topic. There are many ways you can be harmed with workplace wellness. Somebody, in fact, my publisher of one of my books actually said to me, the HR manager said, you know, I did the wellness thing. They told me I was fine. I could lose a few pounds. About a week later, I started getting symptoms that I otherwise would have thought was a heart attack, but I thought, no, couldn't be. I just got my wellness check. So I waited hours and hours before I went to the hospital. So that's one way it can hurt you. Another way is these programs, I don't think they have access to the internet because they will recommend testing like prostate exams for men, thyroid exams for men and women, that all the literature says don't do them because your chances of being overdiagnosed and harmed through treatment overwhelm the chances that you might find something that's legitimately wrong.
I mean,
actually, even to go a step further, there's a word, actually I coined it, it's not really a word, but you can Google on this one, hyperdiagnosis, which is the wellness industry's braggadocio about how many sick people they find. They love to go out hunting for disease. Their motto is overscreening today, overscreening tomorrow, overscreening forever. They love going out and hunting for disease and then telling employers how many sick people they have, and oh, they have to do something about it. If not, in 2 or 3 years, their healthcare costs are going to explode.
In your mind, is all this connected to, is this just kind of one of those follow the money? Is this about big pharma and all that, or is this something bigger?
Well, you know, this is one thing we can't blame big pharma for. This was the business roundtables doing. Okay, so if you go back to the beginning of Obamacare, they were trying to create a consensus. And by the way, I just for the record, I got no political issues here whatsoever. I actually voted for the guy. But this wellness thing was a business roundtable scam, or not scam, a business roundtable way of allowing their companies that are their members to claw back a bunch of the healthcare premiums that would otherwise have to be paid on behalf of employers. So they made up this thing called the Safeway Amendment, where they said, look at all the money Safeway saved with its wellness program. Well, it turned out Safeway didn't have a wellness program. And then, miraculously, this article by a few people appears in Health Affairs a month before the vote gets taken, saying how much money wellness saves, with no disclosure that these people happen to be advisors to President Obama. So you and by the way, the whole article on Health Affairs turned out to be a complete lie. It's been debunked many times. So this whole thing was basically based on two lies, and the whole point of it is to save corporations a lot of their Obamacare money by pushing it back on employees who won't toe the line on getting overscreened.
It gets complicated fast, Al. It really does. Why did you take on this issue for your career? You've done so much in this area and so much research and clearly have so much passion in this area. Why is this the topic for you?
Well, you know, they say the biggest proselytizers are the converts. And I used to be not only drinking the wellness Kool-Aid, I was mixing it up and selling it at a big profit, you know. Mm. And then I started doing some of the math, and I was just horrified at what I had been recommending to people. So I switched sides totally. You can even Google on it. It says there's a blog post someone put out. Founding father of disease management, which is part of wellness, astonishingly declares, my kid is ugly. And I switched to the other side and started warning people against these programs, got blacklisted from all the industry conferences. And it wasn't until recently where I finally figured out kind of a long-term solution that I have a new business model where we kind of educate employees on things like, you know, how much sugar is there in a granola bar, how much radiation is there in a CAT scan, should you put butter on a burn, that kind of thing that doesn't involve any employee privacy issues. And that was how I finally recovered from my bout of integrity.
Wow. Well, it is all very, very compelling, the information that you present. Everybody, the book is called Surviving Workplace Wellness with Your Dignity, Finance, and Major Organs Intact. The author is Al Lewis. Thanks so much for being with us today, Al.
Thank you very much, Amy, for having me on.
You bet, for sure. All right, we are still lots to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. When we come back, we are going to be talking about those unused vacation days. We've all got them. We just never got around to using them. Well, our good friend from the Chicago Tribune is going to pop down and talk to us about that. She is going to let us know what we can do about it in the year ahead. All that and more on 720 WGN. Well, we had a little chat a moment ago about workplace wellness. That sure gave us a lot to think about. I think we can all agree, no matter how you felt about that topic. But let's shift to another workplace issue, and that is vacation. That is unused vacation, because I got to tell you, I think we can agree we all kind of suck at using our vacation. None of us are doing it, and the numbers don't lie that we're just getting not any better at it. So joining us now is Allie Marotti from Chicago Tribune. Hi, Allie. Thanks for joining us today. Whoop, you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
There you are. There you are. Thanks for being with us today. Happy holidays to you. Well, you know, here we are, almost the end of the year, and I think a lot of people, I know I've certainly seen this on social media, a lot of people are suddenly going, oh, dang it, I didn't use my vacation. What am I going to do now? And they're trying to kind of squeeze in all those vacation days right there at the end of the year. And I feel like we had this mm-hmm. conversation last year, so we've just not gotten any better. Is that right?
Yeah, it seems to be the case. I guess more than half of Americans who get paid vacation time won't use all their days by the end of the year. And, you know, it's not just 1 or 2 days. It's actually the average amount of leftover days is 19. So it's kind of a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. And this seems to be, I'm not going to say exclusively American, this problem, this epidemic, but certainly we seem to be doing the worst at it, at this idea of using vacation, where I think culturally in other parts of the world, we see people feeling very differently about vacation. And in the story that you wrote at ChicagoTribune.com, everybody head over there and take a look at this story. You have a couple sentences that that really stick out. But one of them is, we Americans have a confused and contradictory relationship with vacation. I think that nails it, because a lot of times mm-hmm. what we hear is like, it's not worth it to me because I know something will happen while I'm gone, or I'll come back to a mountain of work, or something like, I'm afraid of someone kind of honing in on my game while I'm out. And that seems to be
a lot of people
kind of what we do.
Yeah, they were right. They were scared of like the mountain of work that's awaiting them when they get back. And the good thing is that the most popular reason for not using vacation days was they were banking them for next year. So I think there's a little bit of light there.
Yeah. So for people who can do that, I think there's a lot of places where if you don't use them, you lose them. But if you can bank them and take a month off next year, by all means, go for that. And is this do we see different trends in different age groups, or are we all pretty much not great at this?
Yeah, so the biggest hoarders of vacation days were millennials, and specifically that age group 18 to 25. One in four workers in that age group said that they didn't use a single day all year. And I think a lot of that has to do with them, you know, being new to their careers. They feel like they have something to prove, and they kind of want to break that stereotype we so often give millennials of being lazy or spoiled. And I think it also has to do with technology. You know, vacation days have kind of become the casualty of technology, where our workplaces give us computers, they give us cell phones to work from home, but maybe they don't give us the tools to be able to unplug from that when we do take time off, you know?
Truly, truly. As you point out in the piece on ChicagoTribune.com, American workers left 658 million vacation days unused in 2015, according to Project Time Off. That is a whole lot. So what should we do to be better about this in 2017? Because I think a lot of mental health professionals agree. We see this all the time. We've had people on this very show talking about the importance of we have to disconnect. We have to take that break. And even one of the mental health professionals that I've had on the program said what used to be accomplished in a couple of days off now, because of technology and how plugged in we are, we need about 5 days to get our brain back to a relaxed state.
Right. Yeah, that's the thing. It's taking time off is good for you, and it's good for your employer because it prevents burnout. It helps you recharge, kind of get your creative juices flowing again. And that's good for everyone. But what we need to do is just plan better. One of the experts I spoke with said that with technology, and we're so dependent on our calendars and our phone and everything these days, that if we don't block out time for our vacation, we'll just end up filling that time up with other obligations. Then, you know, it comes to this week in the year and all of a sudden we can't take all of our time. So, you know, we talked about kind of earlier, you spoke about other countries being a little bit better than us. And one of the experts I spoke with, she was like, you know, we don't need to be France and create this huge reputation where we're taking all this time off. We just really need to plan better.
Yeah, it's true. And I think there's a connection between how terrible we are at taking our vacation and really caring for ourselves in that way, and digitizing our calendars. Because, you know, by having a digital calendar, we kind of allow anyone that we work with to put something on our calendar, and it's harder to kind of protect that. Whereas if it's written, that's in your hand, and you can't put anything on there without my permission. I got to put it on there myself, you know. So I think that might be something,
exactly,
too. Maybe we need to protect our digital calendars a little bit better. Well, I hope that we all take that to heart, and we all are a little bit better about this in 2017. I think after 2016 had so many ups and downs, I think we could all use a little break in 2017, that's for sure.
I think you're right.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Again, everybody head to ChicagoTribune.com and read this and other pieces from Ali Marotti. Thanks very much for being with us. Always a pleasure to have you on the show, Ali.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right. We still have tons to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to be talking about Wikipedia and a little bit of a look ahead of technology in 2017. And we're going to be talking about year-end giving. It's not just a matter of answering all those things in our mailboxes, but indeed, there is a strategy to it. We can do this very meaningfully, very thoughtfully, and come out way, way ahead. So we'll be talking about that here in just a bit on 720 WGN. Wintrust Business Lunch, thanks for being with us today. Appreciate you spending part of your Saturday with me, especially on this holiday weekend, for sure. Joining us now on the program is our regular guest, Max Chafkin. He writes for Bloomberg and many other places, and he has recently written a really, really fascinating piece. Head over to Bloomberg.com and check this out. It is all about Wikipedia, and in particular, who is writing Wikipedia entries and why that matters so much. Max, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So talk to us about Wikipedia. I think there's been a narrative for a while that kind of has suggested that the group of people writing Wikipedia articles is perhaps a bit homogenous, and there's not a lot of diversity there. But your piece really takes this on in a pretty in-depth way. So talk us through it, if you would.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically, just in case anybody doesn't know, Wikipedia is an online encyclopedia where anyone can edit an entry at any time. And you would think that that would make it, you know, kind of prone to errors and full of misinformation. But actually, having such a large group of people, you know, basically keeps it honest. And there have been studies showing that Wikipedia is about as accurate as comparable, you know, encyclopedias like Britannica. The thing is, it only works insofar as, you know, the editors actually know what they're talking about, and that you have a diverse pool of editors. So that means you'd want to have, ideally, you know, people with expertise in all sorts of areas, and you'd also want to have people who, you know, come from different backgrounds. And that's kind of where the diversity question comes in. A couple years ago, a New York Times columnist noticed that Harper Lee, the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, one of the great books of American literature, was not listed on the American novelist page. She was listed on the American women novelist page. And so it's sort of interesting where you just, the biases of the group are able to sort of create more bias in the encyclopedia. Wikipedia has been trying to deal with that for a long time. They organize these edit-a-thons where basically people will get together and try to write articles about black people, or try to write articles about women because they're underrepresented in the encyclopedia. And the progress has been somewhat halting, just because even today, despite basically years of effort, the base of editors is still overwhelmingly male and overwhelmingly white.
Right. And with no malicious intent, of course, you know, everybody has their own biases, and it's hard to see around your own point of view. And it's hard to get out ahead of that. And so that's kind of the issue, and why diversity is so important, particularly in this setting for Wikipedia. And I recall there was a writer maybe a year or two ago that she announced that every time she got trolled on the internet, she was going to spend a minute and write about a female scientist and put an entry up about a female scientist on Wikipedia just to try to level it out. So she was like, come at me, trolls, but there's going to be a price you pay for that. So there's a group called Whose Knowledge that seems to be trying to take this on and really promote diversity, not just on Wikipedia, but in other areas of the internet. Talk to us about that group a bit.
Yeah, we wrote about this in the article. I mean, this is a former Wikipedia Foundation employee who basically, you know, got tired of not finding people that were supposed to be on Wikipedia, you know, in the encyclopedia. She'd like try to look up somebody from sub-Saharan Africa who, you know, by all rights should be there, and wouldn't find her, and basically just decided to start writing articles. It's kind of the similar to the example of the woman you just talked about. The interesting thing, just to bring it back to the trolling thing, is that's part of the problem. I mean, part of the problem is that people are afraid that if they write a Wikipedia article, they will get trolled. So what can happen is if your username, you know, betrays your gender or betrays some hint of your identity, or if you choose to write about a figure who is maybe associated with feminism or whatever, those people have then been trolled. So it becomes this kind of what's so cool about the example you cited is it's a way to get out of this kind of sense of a self-fulfilling prophecy where people are sort of there isn't enough representation, so they're afraid to do it, and then they don't do it. So it's just going to take, you know, people working on this. The one thing that is important to say is the Wikipedia Foundation, which is the group that sort of oversees Wikipedia, they care about this, and it's something that they're talking about, and they're trying to put money in. But the bottom line is it's hard to get people to write free encyclopedia articles, you know, spending hours and hours, you know, if they're not interested in it. So it's really a question of getting people, you know, online. And there's also a technical component to this, because it hasn't historically been super easy to edit on Wikipedia. You kind of had to be a geek to do it comfortably.
Yeah, it is kind of its own sort of programming language. It's a little clunky to get the hang of it, for sure. Well, it'll be interesting to see how this continues to unfold, and we'll certainly look to you to keep us updated. But I think this is something we've talked about a while. It seems like this is we're now in kind of a, like, let's do this or don't kind of thing, because it seems like we've sort of been talking about Wikipedia and its issues for a while. And I know I've heard the example you gave, kind of the flip side of that issue is that by sometimes putting someone on there, you're opening them to trolling. So there's that. You know, I think it's really an interesting and like surprisingly complex issue. But so what else do you think we can look forward to in 2017 as we're looking ahead and hoping, you know, we can get some of our tech giants to kind of play more diversely and do all of those things? I know we've got lots of interesting things that seem to be on the horizon, like Snapchat glasses and things like that. Like what do you foresee as being and of course, we have this very interesting incoming administration, too, that might have interesting bearing on technology as well.
So you just hit on the two things that were first to jump in my head. I mean, one is, this is sort of quite a distance from the world of Wikipedia. But, next year, Snapchat, I think probably in the early part of the year, is going to file for an initial public offering. It is probably, the hottest startup in the tech ecosystem, in part because it's such a weird company. And part of that weirdness is, as you said, this new product, the Snapchat Spectacles, which they've released, in a very limited way. I had to wait online for a couple hours here in New York, where I'm based, just for the right to buy a pair. Their IPO and their growth, it represents a possible threat to Facebook and to Instagram, and also maybe, we've been sort of sitting around asking ourselves, like, what's going to be the new hot product? What's the new iPhone? And I think it's slightly far out there to say it's going to be this weird Snapchat thing, but you never know. And I mean, they've definitely created something that's shaking up the ecosystem and getting people talking. I mean, the other big one for 2017 that I'm paying attention to, as far as the tech world, is Trump, and kind of what is the Trump administration going to mean for Silicon Valley and for these tech companies. A big group of CEOs went to Trump Tower recently and met with him, and it's sort of hard to know because the tech world, probably more than any industry, was well behind Hillary Clinton. I mean, being pro-Trump in Silicon Valley is one of the weirder things you can do, because both there's a sort of a cultural liberalness to the place where people are just generally vote Democratic, and also it's a community that is largely made up of immigrants. It also is a very globalist industry. Like, most of Apple's products are made in China, so if Trump were to start a trade war with China, that would be, obviously an interesting situation for Apple, to say the least. There are also, data questions. I mean, Google has been sort of collecting huge amounts of data, and Trump during the campaign, indicated that he thinks the government should have, basically an easier way to look at that data. So I think there's a possible battle there, and I think, it's going to be interesting, because the tech industry, as much as it's opposed to Trump, it also is a part of our economy that's creating jobs. So it'll be interesting to see if they, are at odds next year, or if they start to find, ways that they can work together. And we start seeing things like the carrier deal, where who knows, maybe Apple will agree to make some more products in the U.S. or maybe Google will, or something like that.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting. Well, I certainly foresee you being back with us many times in the year ahead as things develop. I think it'll be a very interesting year for technology.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you so much for being with us, Max Chafkin. Find all the stuff he's writing all over the internets, but especially on Bloomberg. So thanks for being with us, Max.
Thanks, Amy. Merry Christmas.
Thanks, you too. All right, still lots to talk about today. We're going to be talking about year-end giving and how to do it thoughtfully and meaningfully and set yourself up to really do a great job with philanthropy in the year ahead. And don't let that word scare you, because it's a word that anybody can jump on. We'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with me, especially here on a big holiday weekend. Most grateful to you for that, and wishing you a very happy, happy holiday weekend for sure to you and yours. Still lots to do on the program. We are now joined by, we just lost her. I was about to pick up that phone call, but we lost her. We're going to get her back in a second. We're going to be talking with Lisa Dietlin, who is a regular contributor to this program, who talks often with us about philanthropy. And she has this wonderful philosophy that all of us can do philanthropy. All of us can be philanthropists, because we all have something to give. Even if it's not money, we can all give something and contribute in some way that is meaningful. And I really, really love that message. So as soon as we have her back, we will get her on the phone to talk about that, because it is year-end giving time. All of our mailboxes are so filled with all of those wonderful, please and all of those things, where it's like, I know in my case, every time I open the mailbox, there's like a cute little, like a puppy on an envelope staring at me, wanting to, you know, wanting me to give money to that organization and that organization. And it's hard to pick. And especially when, I don't know about you, but I don't have Oprah money. Not yet anyway. So, you know, it's hard to pick which one you're going to support, you know, and there's a lot of thought to it. And sometimes you get stressed out, especially when they send you stuff. That's when I get stressed out, right? When they send me, like, they send me the address labels and you're like, oh man, I didn't order these, but now I got to pay you for them because now you sent them and I don't want you to be out that money, you know, all those things. So that's why we lean on our friend Lisa for that stuff. So here she is joining us now, Lisa Dietlin from the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy and regular contributor to this program and this station. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Amy. How are you? Happy holidays.
Thank you. You too. It's lovely to hear from you. Well, we were just talking here about how we're getting all of those mailers with all the cute puppies and all the cute kitties that need our help, and we're all getting overwhelmed with year-end holiday requests. And so we're looking to you to help us make sense of it, because I know that you have helped us in years past to do this thoughtfully and meaningfully. And so
I'm chuckling because if your mailbox is like mine, let alone your inbox and your text, your messages, you are being flooded and inundated. And so many people say, what can I do? Where do I start?
Yes, absolutely. And it seems like, you know, if you want to give to everybody and they're all good causes you stand behind, but it's like, well, I don't have Oprah money yet. So how do I meaningfully support all these organizations that need my help?
Right. And one of the questions is, and how did I get on these other lists? Because I've never given to those organizations. So, you know, to make it easy for the listeners, the first thing I do is say, don't let guilt drive your philanthropic decisions. These mailers and invitations to contribute are meant to move you emotionally. But, you know, everybody has causes that are near and dear to their heart. So first of all, don't let guilt drive your philanthropic decisions. Second is, set aside all the requests you get. If you're like me, you set aside your bills and you're going to pay them once a month or every couple of weeks or whenever, and set those aside so that you can really give a meaningful gift. Think about what you gave to last year. Do a little bit of an assessment. You know, most of us have a house of worship or we have an alma mater or kids school that we give to. But then what else? What else did you support? And then think about what happened this year. Maybe a family member adopted a child or adopted an animal, and now that's become a really important cause to you. Perhaps a family member suffered an illness, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's or lupus or something, and that's become really important to you. Think about what happened this year and then make decisions. Are you going to give to your house of worship, your alma mater, your kids' school, new nonprofit and new causes that are near and dear to your heart? And then look at your budget. What can you give away? And I've always been, as Amy, you know, a big proponent of giving larger amounts to fewer organizations.
Right, right. And why is that more, is that preferable to say, you know, $10 or $20 to several?
Well, because I think when you give a gift, say you have $100 to give, and instead of giving, you know, 100 organizations a dollar, 10 organizations $10, making $100 donation will actually engage you further with that organization, that you will feel, most people want to know that their donation made a difference. And they say, does my dollar or $10 matter? Yes, it does. Every dollar counts, every penny, every piggy bank busted open and donation giving absolutely counts. Every dollar or coin you drop into those Salvation Army buckets counts. But if you want to know for sure that you had a meaningful impact, a larger amount to fewer organizations will actually get you closer towards your goal.
Very, very good point. And then what about the organizations that like send you things you didn't ask for, like address labels, or like I got a blanket from an animal organization that I can't really use, and you know, someone sent me a t-shirt, and are you obligated to give to those organizations?
You are not. I mean, it is the age-old question, you know, do you use the stickers, the return address stickers if they send it to you? You know, my the one that gives to me a choke in my, you know, breath, you know, gives me that pause is when they actually send a nickel or a dollar, you know, to you and say, oh my gosh, give. You know what? Those are more often than not organizations that don't have astute development programs, astute fundraising programs. They might be hiring a marketing firm that thinks if they send you a blanket or they put a dollar in an envelope, you're more likely to give. But the number one reason that people give is that somebody asks them, meaning a face-to-face ask, or you know, say your mother was diagnosed with a disease, and she says, you know, instead of holiday gifts under the tree this year, if you celebrate Christmas, I'd love everybody to give to this organization so we defeat this disease, so no other family has to go through that. So the number one reason is someone asks. The number two is that they have a relationship with somebody in the organization or that's affiliated with the organization. So when you're getting those, you know, coffee mugs or T-shirts or what have you to prompt you to give, it's actually more likely a marketer trying to get you to that feeling instead of trusting that they will get donations because they're a good cause.
Truly. And then what about these kind of sites like Bidding for Good and things like that where you're basically giving to charity as you're doing the shopping that you're doing anyway? Because I know, you know, for some people just budgets are tight and that happens. Everybody's been there at some point. Budgets are tight and it's hard to find any extra to give away when you're barely making ends meet yourself. Do you recommend sites like those in order to give based on just doing the shopping you're going to be doing anyway?
I do. You know, if you are, as most Americans are, you know, very generous and philanthropic individuals and think, gosh, I want my budget to go far and I've got to get holiday gifts for Aunt Susie, but I also want to give to charity. You know, use some of these sites. I mean, there's online auctions. Bidding for Good is an online auction where you can actually find some deals and some very unique experiences and or gifts that nonprofit organizations are putting up, and then you get the benefit of it. Charity Buzz is another one. Also think about those organizations that support, I would say, economic development in third world and developing countries. So I love UNICEF and its Inspired Gifts catalog where, you know, actually women are trying to start enterprising businesses, be entrepreneurs by making bracelets or scarves or baskets. And you can shop those catalogs online, UNICEF, Heifer International, others, that where you're actually supporting a family and or an individual trying to get to economic, you know, parity in their country to be able to support their family. So shop if you want to actually get something for Aunt Susie, you know, do the UNICEF catalog. If you want to say in honor of Aunt Susie, I'm buying a flock of geese for a family, that's your Heifer International catalog.
I like that. And you know what? You don't have to do any shipping if you're going to be buying a flock of geese for somebody. So last minute shoppers, listen up on that one. You can certainly...
Well, and the other thing with the cows and the geese and, you know, the chickens is that it actually benefits the family because they get milk or they get eggs, but they can actually sell it and start another business that they get that animal that allows them to have nutrition and have access to food, but it also allows them to trade. So they have the milk, someone else has the geese, and they trade milk for eggs.
I love that. There's so many interesting ways that people have found to make the world better. And I love the message you're always bringing to us every time you've joined us on the air about how anyone can participate in philanthropy, even if just giving your time if you don't have the money, or even, as you said once, just giving smiles and a positive attitude, even when we can't do that.
Absolutely. You know, I have a friend who started this about 2 years ago and still does it, but she actually, before she goes shopping, she writes a bunch of little notes, you know, have a great day, you know, hope your holidays are fabulous, you know, wishing you the best in the new year. And when she's around people, she actually drops them in their shopping bag, these little notes, and they don't know she's done that. And then they get home and they have this most wonderful surprise. And that's her way of making a difference. You know, she wants to affect change by her attitude. And she's so happy when she's out shopping. You know, she's not, I can be mad and frustrated. Or I can say, let's turn this around and be positive. And can you imagine getting home and opening up your, you know, package and saying, oh, here's a note. And
I love it.
The loveliest message.
I love that. What a great, great thing to do. I think we can all use that year round, not just at the holidays. I love that idea of showing each other positivity and care. I love that. That's very beautiful. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Lisa Dietlin, the founder and CEO of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. Thanks for being with us today and happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays, Amy.
All right. And, you know, as she always points out, you can always check on the charities that you're giving to. You can head to Better Business Bureau, bbb.org/charity, guidestar.org, or charitynavigator.org and check out those charities because I know there's a ton of them out there and it gets a little confusing. All right. We're going to take a break and turn you over to King John here in just a bit on 720 WGN.